Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 11 of the PreparedX Podcast. I can't believe we're on episode 11 already. We've had some really good interviews recently. In this podcast, I interview Martin Gomberg, who's a global data privacy, business continuity, and crisis management advisor. He has a really interesting background, and he talks a little bit about that at the beginning of this interview. He's also an author and as well as a regular speaker. I spoke to Martin about a variety of interesting topics from cybersecurity, data privacy. We touched on a little bit about the difference between the EU privacy laws compared to the US, as well as we touched on education within the cybersecurity domain. He had some really interesting thoughts on education, so you should check this one out. And that's it. Here's the interview. Good morning, Martin. How are you doing today?
Doing very well, Rob. Thanks.
Just before we get going, Martin, if you could just, for the audience, introduce yourself, just take a few minutes to talk about your career and currently the work that you're up to within the world of business continuity, crisis management.
Absolutely. Be happy to. I probably have what some would consider an unusual background for someone that's in IT governance. I was the CIO of A&E Networks, television network, for more than 16 years. And following that, I assumed the role of Senior Vice President, Global Director of Governance, Security, and Business Protection for the same company. I had a responsibility overall for policy, strategy, and oversight of all aspects of IT security and technical risk governance. I chaired our business continuity efforts, our enterprise privacy efforts, and an advisor executive crisis management team. I was the founder of an organization called Heroes Partnership to advocate public-private partnership. I was formerly vice chair of an industry working group through the State Department Overseas Security Advisory Council. And I was a founding member of the CIO Executive Council, which now has about 700, 800 members. Earlier in my career, I was a vice president of technical strategies for a major bank. I tracked down and reconciled almost $50 billion of Latin American debt. I was a university instructor and a forensic identification specialist to law enforcement and medical examiners in three states. So we got an unusual background across the board for someone who ends up in governance. A year ago, I founded a company called CyberRight. I focus on IT security governance, data protection strategies, and global privacy overall there. And I'm on the faculty of IONS Research and an Ask an Expert consultant there. In that role, I advise and assist CIOs and CISOs in developing, reviewing, validating plans, and resolving complex matters in governance and compliance, continuity at risk. And when I'm not doing this, I've been spending time in Spain and France looking at prehistoric cave paintings. So that's basically me overall.
Well, we appreciate that. That's certainly a varied background and vast amount of experience across the board. So I think our listeners will really appreciate this interview. So I think let's start off with the state of cybersecurity, because it seems to be front and center in the news right now, both challenges for governments and corporations in terms of how they're trying to deal with the various breaches that they come up against. What do you see as some of the specific, key challenges that corporations and governments face when trying to protect their networks? What are some of those current challenges that they face?
Well, let's just start off with where business is at, since that's all been under change. There's few people that wouldn't agree that where we do business, how we do business, and the pace at which we do business, it's all changed.
Yeah.
The consumer changed. Our lines of business and the technologies that support them are converging. new business opportunities are emerging. The role of the CIO is different than it was just 5 years ago. And the role of the CISO is now in transformation, since it focuses less now on IT risk alone and more on an enterprise risk or global concerns. About a year ago, I questioned the panel of experts consisting of a cyber law enforcement person, some CISOs, and cyber defense product specialists as to whether we're winning, losing, or standing still in fighting cyber threats. And the answers, given their different perspectives, were all different.
Mm-hmm.
But what's clear to me, though, is a few things. You know, the threats are increasing. They're becoming more targeted. They're becoming more severe. Our adversaries aren't just individuals or cause-motivated groups anymore, but they're crime syndicates. They're nation-states with tremendous resources and capabilities. And they have different motivations, from theft for the crime syndicates to the destruction of our critical infrastructure for the latter groups. And increasingly, I think we're going to see, we're seeing now, but we're going to see even more, that the lines between virtual and physical attacks are blurring.
Sure.
Which means that the potential for a devastating attack is a growing concern. Overall, our ability to protect ourselves is diminishing. Technologies are emerging to manage and mitigate our threats and bring some order to our environment, but they're complex, they're expensive, they're difficult to use. The staff and skills we need to leverage these tools is increasingly difficult to find. We're watching our geography expand. Our perimeter has expanded into the cloud and into cross-border spaces we don't control.
Right.
Law regulations now hold us accountable for breach of private data and pose incredible penalties. Yet the regulations themselves are becoming more complex. They're cumbersome. They're difficult to follow. This may be a little bit different in Europe, but here there's almost no consistency in the dictates or requirements of federal law across our states and each of the countries in which we operate, municipality laws also impact us. So it's not just that the security is growing more complex. In many of our companies, security is growing organically. It's growing with our needs and our budgetary investments over the year, and it's just inadequate for our current exposures. So some with the resources and expertise to do so will invest and they'll uplift their security platforms to meet the new challenges, but others are going to find that difficult to do and be difficult to fund the creation of the kind of resources you need to manage these services. So they'll need to engage managed services, cloud-based security, and outside expertise to effectively get this to happen. There's also another question, and that's the question of reasonable expectations. Homeland Security published a model that I heard the former U.S. Homeland Secretary Michael Chertoff speak to at a recent State Department meeting, defining risk in terms of threats, vulnerabilities, and consequences. Overall, except the largest and best funded of businesses, there's only so many threats you can follow or respond to.
Right.
And only so many holes you can plug. So for most of us, the best approach is going to be good governance, clean operations, and prudent application defenses. Overall, we each need to develop a strategy that includes education, skills, responsiveness, technical defenses, and data knowledge. We need to know what we have, where we have it, and how compliance with sensitive best practice demands that we protect it. And security is a slide switch. You can slide it all the way to the right, nothing is going to get in, nothing is going to get out, and nothing is going to get done.
Right.
You can slide it all the way to the left, you'll have a great day, but you'll only have one, and then your doors will close. So we need to find the right level of security and controls to effectively meet the requirements of our business. That's going to change and vary depending on the culture, size, industry, the degree of global activity. So there's no one-size-fits-all answer for any of this.
Sure.
That's our biggest challenge.
Sure, and that really goes into, you know, my next thought or question really is, I know you're a big advocate of business continuity, you know, holistically. You know, can you speak for a few minutes about the importance of having that business continuity program, obviously in general terms, and what elements make up that, you know, strong business continuity program? Obviously, that connects to the state of cybersecurity and your previous comments.
Sure. You know, overall, in the way I think about continuity, continuity is not just about crisis. It's a key performance parameter in compliance. It's also critical to any kind of business transformation we do, whether it's through outsourcing, change of structure, or ownership. We focus on the crisis side when we talk about this, but it has all of these varied parameters to it, and much of the work we do overlaps across all of it. It's useful to use a framework in structuring an effective business continuity program, and also in communicating its importance to the business and making it understandable and explainable, and to ensure that we have the proper focus, attention, and effective support. I use something called COSO, which is an effective framework overall for developing a program of ethics, security, privacy, compliance, or continuity. But it's an effective framework, and it defines largely six areas of focus. These include assuring executive oversight,
yep,
clarity of message to the company, which is key, building a culture of adherence to governance and a community adoption of continuity practices. You need an understanding and inventory of your risks, whether it's assessed from the perspective of specific threats, like or typical scenarios, or classes of threats in the models that we use. It needs to address the implementation of the mitigating controls, baseline assessment of where you are, what the gap is, and a metric or methodology for reporting on progress, and offer up a program of awareness and training and overall education. Other frameworks work equally well as long as they address, govern, document, communicate all of the clarity around all of those areas of the program. It's my belief that to be effective, continuity needs to be embedded in the fabric of the business.
Right.
And it should harden the business structurally to resist crisis. And I use as an example, a widely distributed regional fulfillment set of centers would reduce the impact of a local event that would cripple a single centralized facility or several facilities that have been clustered in an area for the convenience of operations. So there's a balance that needs to be reached between risk mitigation and ease of operations. In general, a hardened business is going to be a better structured business, and that's what we should aim for as part of our continuity plan. And when I look at this, I look at this in terms of businesses as having an inherent shape. The shape might be it's distributed, diverse, or redundant at supply. It'll be concentrated perhaps at manufacturing and diverge again on the side. So it may have been planned that way for convenience, or it may have morphed over time through growth and opportunity. So understanding the inherent characteristics of that business helps to determine where the business is effectively exposed to potential threats and where changes should be considered. And it helps in identifying opportunities.
Yeah.
So for instance, a review of the clients list can reveal that you have heavy concentration in one industry or region. And that's a problem if that industry or region comes under pressure.
Right.
So perhaps you should be changing sales strategy. Single supplier sourcing contracts may have been a requirement as a startup, but now might be a constraint as a grown company. So we need to be looking at all of these kinds of things in terms of shaping our business continuity plans and hardening our business to be inherently and intrinsically resistant to crisis.
Right. Thank you for that. And you mentioned earlier on, you really just touched on privacy, and certainly you mentioned the EU. So I'm interested, obviously being an expat Brit myself, now living here in the States, what's the major differences between the privacy requirements in comparison to the US? You touched on it briefly back there. Can you just talk about a few of those major variances between the two?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. One of the things I did when I was at A&E Networks is I was appointed to be the data protection officer for our offices in Italy, and serve effectively as a proxy for the employees in the Italian offices, so that somebody was representing their interests independent of the activities of the company. And that's important because the cultural focus of the laws in the U.S. favor the competitiveness and rights of individual companies. In Europe, it's the opposite. In Europe and in many places elsewhere now, the privacy and rights of employees and consumers takes precedent. As these laws evolve, it appears that the divergence is only increasing, and expectedly will continue to do so.
Right.
So I've spoken to a number of privacy and data protection specialists across Europe and elsewhere recently, and that whole structure of the law and regulation is in flux. But there are a couple of general parameters that remain true and impact us as security professionals most heavily. In Europe, the protection of personal information is considered a fundamental right.
Right.
And the responsibility of protecting personal data, assuring its care, minimizing its use and access to that which has been agreed and intended, assuring that the obligation for that protection persists even when third parties are engaged, and assuring that this care is auditable and can be affirmed, and assuring that if requested, that data can be removed and the individual has the right to be forgotten. That's all core, and it's a fundamental commitment of the entity that's retaining personal data on behalf of any European citizen. And any limit now to the protection of personal information needs to be minimal.
Yep.
It needs to be proportionate to the needs of the company, and those needs need to be legitimate. And it has to be performed with informed consent. This is the basis for questioning the applicable use in Europe, many of the technologies we take for granted here as part of our security monitoring toolkit. For instance, the technologies we develop to protect our corporate enterprise here often use deep drill down monitoring and investigation of individual behavior. That's fundamentally at odds with privacy and labor laws, sometimes even illegal or criminally illegal in some countries overseas. So this could include, or at least limit, the use of web filtering, access monitoring, and data loss protection systems, just to name a few. So this is particularly the case if you're using a monitoring technology that has ramifications for an employee, potentially including on detection of poor behavior, dismissal.
Right.
This effectively would be illegal. So there's a fundamental cultural divide here. Even in the current environment with increasing threats and terrorism, where surveillance and monitoring are tempting, I only see this convergence, divergence as only increasing.
Sure. Get back to cybersecurity for a minute here, and I posed this question recently to another cybersecurity expert, and our listeners are really intrigued with what's going on in the cybersecurity world right now. In general terms, there are obviously many threats that come up almost daily now. You can read various different articles. Some come and go, and some stay for a while. What are three of the current, two or three of the current cybersecurity threats that you see that organizations are facing, and how are they dealing with these types of threats, and what impact is it having on them?
Yeah, this actually was a very interesting question, and I perhaps come from a different perspective on this, but personally, I think discussing specific threats in this context is less interesting than talking about vulnerabilities. So I'm going to take the liberty of changing the focus of the question.
Sure, go ahead.
Because it doesn't matter who the bad guy is. If his goal is to come through the door, and if you have a good door and a good lock in place, to stop him. So addressing the vulnerabilities mitigates numerous threats.
Sure.
It doesn't matter whether it's a government or a company, big or small, local or global. Most companies are plagued by a basic few prominent vulnerabilities, and it's the source of almost every exploit I can think of. So regardless of our greatest attack, regardless of the attack, our greatest attack surfaces come down to three things. It's people, our operational hygiene, and our lack of awareness of what we have, where it is, why we have it, and how it should be protected. We get those three things under control, and the majority of the attacks that plague our companies and populate our news reports, et cetera, become moot, and the newspaper headlines become uninteresting.
Right.
With people, whether an attack is through social engineering, phishing, an inadvertent click on a malicious link, or an attempt at, for convenience or productivity purposes, carrying a laptop with you and exposing data unintentionally to loss or theft, or even breach of law, the actions or inactions of people are the greatest source of exposure to any company or government. Education, operational processes and technology together are the best mitigation we have to threats that compromise people or the endpoints from which they interact with the network. And education itself is the first line of defense. Part of the education is imparting a sense of ownership and
right.
responsibility to the individual, for security of the company and the protection of its data. They need to make the right decisions. They need to use good judgment, and they need to speak up when mistakes have been made or activities or suspicious things happen without fear of ridicule or reprisal. And, that's part of developing a culture of security, as we talked to about before when talking about continuity. The same concept of developing a culture is critical here. And our people are our first line of defense, and they need to be brought into the process and this culture of security promoted. And I found that when presented with an operational process with sensible policies, clear direction, a program of threat awareness, education, and guidance, a classification of data that defines what needs special protection so people know what to do, and a means to accomplish their goals safely, typically most people will comply. And you add to that informed advocate on your behalf for security technologies like
right.
passwords, inactivity timeouts, encryption, endpoint threat detection, whitelisting. All of these, basically promote a much more effective protection of the main entry point for most attacks into the company. The second is operational hygiene. When people are on the, where people are let me say it this way, where people are the vulnerable point of access by which threats most frequently gain access, once inside, the greatest attack surface and means of exploit is simply that which we've administratively or operationally neglected, yep. often out of convenience. Identity management, authentication, authorization, system network access controls, right to the applications and the data. If all of this stuff is properly managed, this is the first step in removing consequence of most breacher attack. You know, how frequently are network access IDs left active after an employee departs a company?
Right.
Or for use by a temp who's going to be covering their functions for a month or two.
Sure.
Or to use as a template for the creation of other accounts requiring similar access. This is exactly the kinds of stuff that accumulates in the access controls of systems within a company that create these back doors,
right.
And pretty much assure that you're going to have these openings that people can exploit. You know, how often do rights accumulate for an individual as they change their roles? You know, how effectively do we control administrative or other privileged account passwords? And how effectively do we manage which administrators can do what on which systems, when, and with what authorization? We grant way too much power to our administrators to cover way too many systems without effective controls around that.
Right.
So operational hygiene is the second of the, you know, the key areas in which we need to be concerned. And the last being awareness. You know, what is consequential data? Ask most people, they don't know. You know, consequential data is all about crown jewel assets and our intellectual property. It's our company confidential data, you know, executive compensation lists, sales plans, things of that sort. And it's also the data which we're required by law and regulation to protect. And every week we see reports of another massive breach and theft of that critical data. But if pressed, most companies will admit that they don't have a good handle on what data they have, why it's important, who owns it, and if it's still relevant and needed.
Right.
We don't know what we have, we don't know where we have it, how important it is, how long we need to keep it, and if it requires special care to protect it. So this is an enormous exposure to the company's confidential and critical IP, and it's also a potentially massive legal liability if the privacy of individuals from overseas is compromised. And, you know, so this is potentially magnified as we deal with more and more jurisdictions, more and more countries. So the potential risk here is very, very high. So I think an inventory and classification of data addresses much of this problem by identifying that which needs to be protected and assuring that the right protections in place, including the use of encryption where it's needed, assuring that data that no longer is needed has been removed, and that high-value data is properly identified and policies have been built that direct employees as to how that data should be handled and what authorizations are needed. So overall, an educated, aware, and involved staff, cleanliness in operations, and effective management of systems and data alone, before making any new investment in technology and defenses, provide you a very capable defense.
That's fantastic information, and I think the listeners will really appreciate that. You know, the cybersecurity space is growing so fast. We see businesses popping up all the time to try and, you know, mitigate one issue or another. I noticed that on your LinkedIn profile, you have a number of professional qualifications from various, you know, institutions and locations. Where do you personally think the industry needs to strengthen or modify in terms of the current cybersecurity education that's available?
Yeah, there's a few things we need to be doing, both in educating the pipeline of trained cybersecurity people that need to come our way, and also in educating ourselves and the sharing of information between us, so that we as a community of the good guys can put up a more effective response to those that are attacking. You know, we have a tremendous shortage of trained cyber specialists, and many companies in the cybersecurity space have been already or are starting to partner with schools to train and certify students early and position them for jobs before they graduate.
Right.
We need to do more of this, one for the jobs and good career directions for young people, but also because we have a weak pipeline directing people with the capability to actually address some of these problems into the field. At a higher level, business schools, law schools, universities need to increase attention to cyber data protection and privacy. Those that are coming out of business schools, law schools, and universities are inadequately trained don't effectively, with fields as large now as privacy and data protection and cyber issues becoming legal issues and governed by the actions of legislation and varying across so many different jurisdictions, we need to have people who understand all of this stuff to help to clear the path and guide the path for us. And these people are hard to find.
Sure.
I think another area, too, where we could do good and at the same time see that benefit is we should work with the military.
Right.
That's where, that's the place where we see most of the best trained, the best qualified, not only cyber trained people, but also people focused with the right kinds of disciplines so that if you give them the tools, they can apply it. So we should be working with the military to ensure that cyber training specialists have a direct pipeline to jobs in the private sector at the end of their service. And perhaps even feeding them the guidance as to what are the things that they need to learn while engaged in the military. One of the other things I think is that private sector companies need to more effectively partner with the public sector. There's concerns of confidentiality, stigma, reputation damage, and they're still prevalent in many companies, which prevents them from revealing when they've been breached. And this limits our ability to create any kind of unified front against attackers. It limits our reach. And it minimizes our ability to leverage the best of what the private and public sector can each offer. So we need to do that better, and we need to, as companies, partner with each other, either within our industry, whether with competitors or not, and reach beyond our industry for new information so that we can get a better handle on the threats that are coming our way and create this more cohesive front to our defense. And I think if we do those things, we'll have established an effective pipeline and we'll have established the necessary communication to do this stuff well.
That's fantastic information. And we have a number of our listeners certainly up here in the Northeast. We're up in Rhode Island, and Rhode Island's doing a lot in terms of trying to at the education level at various universities and colleges, have got a number of courses that are up and running, and the state's pushing cybersecurity at that level. And so your points here will be well received, certainly within the community closer to our home, I'm sure beyond. So appreciate that insight. As a cybersecurity advisor, what's the most common request that you get from a chief information officer in terms of supporting them?
It's interesting that I see much of the focus I see comes from two distinct directions, and it's new technology companies that are looking to bring defensive or protective capabilities to market and they're wanting the guidance as to how to position their platform. That's one direction from which I get inquiries and am asked to advise. And then on the corporate side, the questions I typically get are continuity, governance, compliance, and privacy. So it's interesting that the corporate focus has been less directed at the new tools and more at effective management of business and process. And frankly, I find that encouraging. I find that encouraging because, one of the difficulties CISOs have in general in getting the support that they need within the companies they work for is a difficulty in communicating the message that what I need in order to effectively protect you is not just more money to spend.
Right.
What I need is I need your support and the clarity of the message from the top. I need to build the culture. I need to identify my risks. I need to come up with approaches, both operational and other. Maybe some of that other is technical, to mitigate some of those risks. And I need to promote education awareness, and I need to measure the stuff so I know if we're being successful. That message is having a hard time percolating up. And if it percolates up, I think that the role of the CISO will become that much more successful. But perhaps to some extent it is, in the fact that we are seeing a transformation amongst the CISO role. Where it is becoming more generally risk-focused and more enterprise-focused and less specifically IT spend. And this is an important issue because the CIO role, as I mentioned before, is transformed. You know, whereas before, as CIOs, we had responsibility for effective operations, innovation and advancement, budgetary controls, security and risk. Now, one of the things that's happening to the CIO is they're asked to be doing more faster and faster, taking the business further and further into new spaces and in alignment with new markets and where the business wants to go. With all of that, you worry that if they have X number of dollars to spend, will they allocate it towards meeting the speed that they need to move forward? Will they allocate it towards, meeting the requests of the CISO to invest in the technology to protect the business volume? You know, so we worry about this. And as I see this divergence more of the CISO role to focus more on this enterprise side discussion, I think that perhaps that's a good sign that says that there may be some separation of these roles and that the CISO can help to pick up some of the slack as the CIO role continues to transform. So I think it may be an interesting sign of things to come.
That's good. Good. Well, that's an interesting insight from your perspective as you're out in the thick of things on a daily basis. What's your position on the Apple v. FBI debate, if we can call it a debate at all? Obviously, there's two sides to this. Where do you sit? I know you have a privacy background. At the same time, obviously, you have a security background as well. So where do you sit on this and kind of what's your opinion on the whole debate?
You know, I almost always dread that someone will ask this question.
feel free to sit on the fence.
No. I actually have a better way to approach this in that I yet have a third view. You know, this is both a tough and it's a delicate question.
Sure.
My privacy side, I'm sensitive to both positions.
Of course.
I fully respect Apple's concern that the breaking down of the walls of autonomy and privacy for private sector companies on a government demand, that's a slippery slope. And I think that it's more the concern for this than the current request, in fact, whether stated or not, that Apple is responding to. And I support that. You know, but that said, I also have the security side, and I come from close affiliation with law enforcement. I also believe that protecting life above all takes precedence over everything. And I also believe that we are at war. You know, so we're in a very tough position in balancing this request. We're in a tough position in that there is a privacy concern here. There is also a public safety concern here. And both of them are very serious concerns. Apple's concerned about the creation of a backdoor, or at least this is what they've stated. They're concerned about the creation of a backdoor to a security that could be exploited later. The FBI is saying they're not asking for a breach of encryption, but a relaxation of the maximum retries on password guessing before the device lock,
right,
so that they can use their own brute force methodologies to acquire a password and open that specific phone. You know, Apple's also said that this debate should shift to Congress. That, to me, is the last thing that we want. You know, one, the effectiveness of Congress is one question, but
right,
secondly, you know, a knee-jerk reaction embedding law around this can compromise our privacy and rights for a very long time and may achieve exactly the opposite results that we're hoping for here.
Sure.
So I'm hoping we don't see this go down the path of going to Congress. But actually, I have another perspective. You know, I worked for a small company where the data center help desk and IT department all coexisted on the same floor because of the, you know, the perceived sensitivity of the data that we held. And, you know, so the doors were all locked to the floor and access to the floor required an escort. We had an executive come down to go to the help desk, and he was offended that he required permission to get on the floor to visit the help desk. He complained to senior management, and our facilities director was instructed to unlock the door on the floor to all employees. So the facilities director came to me and said, what should you do? Well, I said, what do you mean, what should you do? You should unlock the door. I'd rather know that the door is unlocked than think that it's secure when you can unlock the door at any time and open it. You know, and for me, this is basically the same problem. You know, if the creation of an iOS version with maximum retries set to a billion is a trivial task, then we're not secure. Someone else can do it besides Apple. If it's accomplishable at all, there's certainly people out there currently or formerly with Apple that can do this, and so we're not secure. If it's impossible to do, then the discussion is academic and Apple should just say it can't be done.
Right.
However, if there's a possibility that the system can be breached, whether by people outside or within the company, I, and I'm sure Apple, would want to know.
Right.
You know, so my perspective here is there's a tug of war over an issue. But the bigger question is, how trivial a matter is the alteration of the iOS and access to the phones, how trivial the matter or how complex the matter is this in fact? And, you know, how secure are we from disgruntled, if there ever was a disgruntled Apple employee, I don't know if there ever was, but
right,
a disgruntled Apple employee creating one of these things as a backdoor. I would want to know that because I would love to know, as I believe, that this is a very difficult thing to do. But I'd like to know that for sure. And that actually happened to come forth in much of the discussions. But sensitive matter, I fully support all of the grief that Tim Cook is going through and Apple is going through. But I also understand that, yes, we are at war.
Yeah. I don't think we've heard the end of this, and we'll keep our ears to the ground of how this pans out. I just finally for our listeners, and for the younger generation or those that might be thinking of getting into this space, in terms of thinking of a career change, what advice would you have for those individuals?
For younger people getting into this space, I think this is an industry that's not going to go away. It's an industry that's challenging, and a profession that's interesting, and it's a profession that's critical. When I say we were at war, we're in this profession partners with our governments and with all other companies in providing the best possible unified front against people who want to exploit and damage our companies, our infrastructure, our government, our finances. So much of this yet is to come. We need people out there who can help us protect all of that and push back and help us gain an upper hand. When I talked about that panel of experts that I had interviewed a year or so ago and mentioned a member of law enforcement who was from the FBI, his opinion was, and one of the foremost experts at the FBI, his opinion was, this is a battle that we're losing. And we need the help of new minds, new approaches, new ideas coming into this to help us to move this battle forward. For people changing professions, I think it's, this is a wonderful place to be considering. One, because there's so many different aspects of it that you can come to, either from security, from compliance, from risk, from telecom, from so many different directions that if looking to transform a career, this is a great place to go. I moved from being the CIO of a company for 16 years to being its global director of security, governance, and business protection.
Sure.
To me, it was one of the best moves I made. This is a fascinating field with so much of interest to do. It's exactly the space I want to be operating in. So I couldn't make a greater recommendation than here for people who are looking for a place to park.
That's just a fantastic way to wrap this up. And, your advice and your comments and your experience that you provided us in this this podcast today is just phenomenal, and I appreciate that. Do you have any final words, Martin, for our listeners? Also, where can they get a hold of you if they want to touch base with you?
I'm either reachable directly by email, martinj.berg@gmail.com. I would certainly welcome anyone directing that. Anybody wants to find me on LinkedIn, that's an easy way to reach out to me. I also have a number of papers and thought documents posted there, so that may be of some interest to some. And I'm also available through IONS Research, where I'm a faculty member, so through their website as well, IANS Research. So that is a another way in which you can reach me. Always happy to chat and share thoughts and welcome new ideas. So pleasure to have met you all.
That's great. Well, again, appreciate your time today, Martin. I hope you have a wonderful day, and I look forward to future discussions.
Thank you, Robin. You as well.
Take care. That's it for episode 11 of the Prepared X podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as usual. Please feel free to share this podcast. I think this one will be very well received. Also, I'd like to let you know about the Crisis Conference that we've got coming up on March 31st in Boston. If you go to crisisconferences.com, that's crisisconferences.com, you can check out all that information. There's probably a couple of weeks to go by the time you're listening to this. That's March 31st, 2016. We look forward to seeing you in Boston. Until next time, have a safe and enjoyable day. Take care.